I think it's always important for us as human beings to have some sense of our larger context. We have experiences that, as Carrie described, I think so well for herself this morning, that leave us kind of in the space of, frankly, I don't know what to do. I don't know how to proceed. I don't know what this means, whatever the things are that leave us in that space of profound not knowing. And I think one of the things that can help us, it's not magic, but one of the things that can help us in those moments is taking the time to recontextualize the experience we're having just a little bit, to do what we can to sort of try to set it into a bigger frame. And that's one of the reasons why we do this as well as a community, why we acknowledge the physical space that we're in and some of its history. One of the things I love about taking the time for this acknowledgement together as a community is that it's an acknowledgement of not just who was where when, but that the thing we do together here on a Sunday morning, how does this fit with life, all that kind of stuff, man, that's an old, old enterprise for the species. And just something as simple, if I can use that word, or straightforward as this acknowledgement reminds us that whatever it is that we're on about here, no matter how profound it may be, no matter how impacting it may be, it resides in a larger frame. Teresa and Wally and I were talking about another detail together this morning, and Teresa was talking about this experience of being outside recently out by Victoria Beach and, you know, away from the lights of the city, and just this experience of there are so many stars. How can you look at that? This is one of the things that where you hear the voice of the agnostic or the atheist coming back to you with a, yeah, you're right, there's something going on, is that those kind of moments where you look at the cosmos and go, oh, God, that's really big. How does this experience fit with that? That's important to do that. When we breathe, we do that as well. This is one of the reasons why we do this together. It's because that takes us right down to the bottom of this shared experience. This is something that we have in common. No matter how conflicted we might be, how estranged we might be, how complicated our circumstances might be, right down there at the bottom somewhere, this is the thing we share. We share breath. And so when we breathe together, I think it allows us, at least in a small, limited way, to acknowledge we have this together. Not sure just what to do with that sometimes, but we need to remember this. So let's read this aloud together, and then we will breathe together, and then eventually I'll tell you which story I was thinking of. All right, so together. We acknowledge that we gather on original lands of Anishinaabe, Cree, Oji-Cree, Dakota, and Dene peoples, and on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We respect the treaties that were made on these territories. We acknowledge the harms and mistakes of the past, and we dedicate ourselves to move forward in partnership with Indigenous communities in a spirit of reconciliation and collaboration. All right. Let's breathe together. I don't think I need to explain the practice to anyone in the room. We're all familiar. Last week, our first gathering of the new year, we reflected a little bit on why a community of exploration like the table might still be important. And in particular, in that reflection, I wanted to emphasize that when our world feels like it's going a little bit topsy-turvy, one of our normal human responses is often questions about what this might mean, both for us personally and then sort of outward in ever-widening circles that come to include things like the world, the future, even what might come after our experience of this world, so reflections and queries about life after this life. And in that reflection, we explored a little bit how it might be important in asking those sorts of questions to connect our new ideas to ancient ideas, something that we've sort of touched on already this morning as well.
And I suggested in that reflection that one of the reasons it matters to do that sort of work of connecting what we think of as new ideas to ancient ideas is because it can help us see what types of answers have in the past led to things like rest and peace. And things that both our own experience and what we know of humans in the past seems to be what I would call a shared legacy of longing. I think most of us as humans really, really, really want to know the experience of peace and the experience of rest. And it's not that easy to come by. We want to know what it would be like to have some moments where we don't feel worried or where we don't feel stressed out or where we don't feel exhausted. Maybe we especially want to know what it might be like to live in a world where we don't feel like we're constantly looking over our shoulder at, you know, the approaching apocalypse of some form or other. That's not an easy space to find these days, since pending doom seems to keep us glued to our screens. Now, there's a part of me, the part that's been raised on the ideals of democracy, that sometimes wonders what would happen to the content of the news if we all just refused to consume the steady diet of trouble is coming that we most often get fed. I think that would be a revolution, both unanticipated and probably quite unlikely, but it's an interesting thing to think about. In the meantime, we have this life to live. We have this day, we have these next moments, at least. And I think generally speaking, we want to live them as well as we can, no matter what our circumstances might be. Now, some of us in this room have grown up with our context being deeply surrounded by strongly hegemonic stories about what we need to believe in order to experience peace and rest. Hegemonic, if that's not a familiar word, just think hedge, like a border around something, and that might help. Stories that basically say, especially in religious context, that basically say something like, believe this set of propositions or affirm this set of creeds and you will know peace, even when it's not reasonable for that to be the case, right? Peace that passes understanding would be a biblical phrase that often gets used in a context of presenting ideas like that. In a community like this one that exists to explore what we believe, my experience has led me to believe that for many of us, there are a variety of ways in which those narratives that say, believe this set of propositions and creeds and you'll know peace, that set of ideas has failed us. And we might feel like we've kept the rules. We went to the church that said it believed the right things. We went to the right school. We married the right person. We're on the right career path. We did whatever the boundary markers for our side of the deal might have been. And the way that the story was presented was that if we did that part, if we kept our side of the bargain, in return, what we got was God on our side. It's called in religious jargon being blessed by God. And that meant that life should be good in the ways that we measure goodness. So if we were an ancient tribal society, that would mean things like we had lots of kids and we had lots of cows and camels and we had lots of land, and when we went to war, we won. In short, it meant that we would be enjoying the Roman version of peace, which is we win, you lose, and we get the spoils. As an aside, I think this offers about as good a moment as any to point out that the Roman version of peace didn't come with anything like rest then or now. It comes at the cost of constant vigilance, constant violence, and constant outward expansion at any cost. Does any of that sound familiar? Right? I mean, it's not that hard to see the roots of our civilization. In any case, there are people in this room and in the wider culture around us for whom that narrative in general, keep your side of the deal and God's side of the deal means that you'll get good things, that's just stopped working for a huge variety of reasons. And you know, it's interesting to me that in my conversations with people, it's not just the people that can't find work or that are victims of oppression and violence for whom that narrative has stopped working. In many cases, it's those of us who, by any global measure, have it made that are having this experience as well. it just looks to more and more people, I think, like that story arc isn't defensible. Or even if you defend it and you stand back from it a little bit, you realize it's not sustainable. And the only way it works is under a very unique, very particular, very time-bound set of circumstances. So, at least in many of the stories that I'm aware of in this community, we've found ourselves unable to buy that story or live out of that narrative with anything like joy, never mind anything like peace or rest. One final sort of establishing shot to set the scene, and then I'll get on to that weirdly hopeful story that I referenced in the blurb. Lots of us were told that it was the stories in the Bible that laid out that whole set of ideas that I've just tried to sum up. That story arc of believe and do what's right, get blessed, and have a good life. And so when that story arc stopped looking believable to us, so did the stories in the Bible. Because those things were woven together. They were fused in our education and our formation of our mind and our spirit and all these things. They were just interlocked. And so when the story arc stopped looking believable to us, so did the stories to which they were connected. They're so locked together that for many of us, it's extremely difficult to imagine one without the other. And as a result, lots of people, in my experience, have just felt like I have to walk away from the whole thing. Or I have to just sort of acknowledge more or less what I just tried to sum up and go, well, swallow hard, I'm staying in. Sort of a kind of willful blindness about the problems. So part of what I want to do today is suggest that there is a way to read this crazy collection of stories called the Bible that can encourage those of us that find ourselves living life as explorers of belief more than of adherents or proponents of a particular set of beliefs, more as people that feel like they don't belong where they came from than as people who are defenders of where they came from. It's hard to make short statements about something this complicated. So if you feel like all of that's amiss, then just take it as the limitations of the communicator and try to pick out an idea that's important to you in there. And I want to also say before I kind of get into this, that when it comes to this library, this collection of stories that often just gets called the Bible, the way that I'm talking about coming to those stories is not that same sort of magical reading that some of us grew up around where we come to the text sort of expecting to hear a word directly from the divine. This is a pretty different approach. It's more like reading a map, where you have to take a flat piece of paper with representative lines on it and translate it into a fully dimensioned experience. Maps are weird. And if you've ever tried to find your way someplace complicated with one, especially if it's someplace without roads, where you're just working with a map that has landforms on it, you know how much imagination it takes to turn that dimension of something into this. If we could make a map of the world that was actually accurate, we would just have made the world, of course. Right? So that kind of work takes enormous imagination. When it comes to text, I think one of the most lovely pictures that I've heard about this recently, especially when it comes to things like sacred text, is somebody pointed out to me recently that if you just look at the page, this is not sacred text, I'm just using it as an illustration, these are my notes, right? But if you look at the page and you think, just do the math on how much of it's black text and how much of it's white space, most of it's white space. And it's sort of like the text itself is the lines on the map, and the white space is all the room that we have, or the notes on the page if you prefer. If you're thinking of a musical metaphor, and the white space is the room we have to dance with them. There's lots of room for imagination, and not just permission, but necessity, just like if you were reading a map trying to get somewhere. Now, all of that can be rather disconcerting, I think, at the same time that it can be exciting. And my hope is that what we'll see shortly is how this path, this way of coming at this, is not just disconcerting and exciting, but it's also ancient and well-trodden, and that if we think of ourselves as explorers, we are in the company of a great cloud of witnesses. We are surrounded by this whole experience of being spiritual explorers. Not all of those companions on a journey like that are from the distant past. I think it's important that there are those, but there are also contemporaries. Henri Nouwen, whom some of you will be familiar with Nouwen's work, both as a writer and as an advocate for social justice and care for those on the margins. I think of him as a contemporary Christian, contemplative for sure, perhaps a mystic. When Nouwen is writing about some of these things, he writes about it this way, and the metaphor he uses is moving from an old country to a new country. He says this, "You know that what helped and guided you in the old country no longer works. But what else do you have to go by? You are being asked to trust that you will find what you need in the new country. That requires the death of what has become so precious to you. Influence, success, yes, even affection and praise. These are all things that are also often locked in our human experience to what I would call adherence. Keep the rules and you get these things. Trust, Nouwen says, is so hard since you have nothing to fall back on. Still, trust is what is essential. The new country is where you are called to go, and the only way to go there is naked and vulnerable. And I would add, and we'll return to this, it's best not to go alone. So, in light of some of those thoughts, here's a story from the Bible about some folks that have traveled this road before we have. The story happens in the book of Acts, so it's not Moses. Acts is a record of the first 30 years or so of the formation of Christianity. And as a biblical book, it's a curious combination of sort of meticulous details and enthusiastic cheerleading. It's easier to see the details because the way it's written kind of comes off like it's about the details. But if you stand back from it and think about its context a little bit, you realize there's a lot of cheerleading for this nascent thing called Christianity that's actually going on in there. So among other things, the context for this story is in a document that tells the story of a group of people that are in the throes of trying to make meaning of the world around them, and they're doing that in light of this experience that they've had with this Jewish rabbi named Jesus. So we're not going to explore that perspective today, but one intriguing lens through which we could look at the book of Acts is that it's the story of a revolution, or if revolution feels like too militant a word for your sensibilities, a story of a new way of ordering the world, of looking at everything. But it's the story of that kind of a movement in culture that still hasn't figured out exactly who it's for and what the implications of that reordering might be. So there's a lot of what the in Acts. Like, what do we do with this? How do we think about this? What does this mean? There's lots of that going on in there. And it's important to also realize that this is all happening, this first 30 years of the formation of the thing we now call Christianity. This is also happening when that same group of people that are trying to form this encounter with this rabbi into a religion, because Jesus didn't do that, we did that. So they're in the middle of doing this at the same time that the Romans are basically going, oh no you don't, and they're landing on that movement super hard, and so these people are also being dispersed. There's a diaspora happening at the same time. So they're under a lot of pressure. So those are all some of the background dynamics of what's going on. They're being dispersed ideologically, they're being dispersed geologically, and so one of the things that a movement that's under that kind of pressure needs is it needs strong stories to bind it together and to validate it and to say, hang in there, we have this in common. This is our story, right? So those are all sort of important background things to what's going on in the book of Acts. In any case, on to the story. This particular story is in Acts chapter 8, which tells, among other things, a few stories about this character named Philip. There's more than one sort of significant Philip in the New Testament stories. This happens to be the one that has come to be known as Philip the Evangelist for reasons that are going to be apparent in the story and also because they're referred to by that title later in the book of Acts. I want us to keep in mind, as people that don't mind exploring, that I'm not assuming, I'm going to read you the text of the story in a moment, but I'm not assuming that the text is meant to be taken literally. There are details in this story, and that's what I was talking about before, how Acts is kind of this combination of detailed sort of history and cheerleading. There are details in the story that might not be literally believable, and that's probably for the obvious reason that the story was written down both to record and to make sense of the spread of this new thing called Christianity, and to do that in a way that actually made sense to the people of the culture for whom the story was written, because it wasn't written for us. The writer wasn't thinking of anybody in this room. And I really don't care what theological position you have about the superintendence of the Spirit over the sacred text. There's just no way that's a defensible idea if you think about the writer's experience. Editorial moment. If we try to read this as Western history, we're going to be in trouble from verse 1, because verse 1 says, "Now an angel of the Lord said to Philip." And intriguingly, and I had a chance to study some of this with the people who translated it, intriguingly, if you go back a couple of older translations, that's not what it says in English. The older translation said, "Now the Lord said to Philip." So we're already coming back to the original language, such as we have access to it, and going, I'm not sure that phrase in the original language actually means the Lord. I think it means the angel. We don't know what that phrase means. Spiritual experience? Something I can't explain, but I want to attribute to something, etc. See what I'm saying? Anyway, don't take it all literally, or you'll miss the good part of the story, because you'll get hung up. So, with that in mind, here's the story as the good folks who translated the NIV version of the Bible have rendered it for us. All right? "Now an angel of the Lord said to Philip, 'Go south on the road,'" the desert road. Don't get the wrong road, Philip, or this is going to go sideways. "Go south to the road, the desert road that goes down from Jerusalem to Gaza." So he started out, and on his way, he met an Ethiopian eunuch, an important official in charge of all the treasury of the Kandak, which means Queen of the Ethiopians. Interesting little bracketed note, because some translations will just say that he was the treasurer for the Queen of Ethiopia, and the NIV translators were careful to say, we also don't know what that word means, but it's got something to do with working in the government and being a highly placed official. Be careful with your history. This man had gone to Jerusalem to worship, and on his way home was sitting in his chariot reading the book of Isaiah the prophet. The Spirit told Philip, "Go to that chariot and stay near it." Then Philip ran up to the chariot and heard the man reading Isaiah the prophet. "Do you understand what you're reading?" Philip asked. "How can I?" the Ethiopian replied, "unless someone explains it to me." So he invited Philip to come up and sit with him. This is the passage of Scripture the eunuch was reading. "He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a lamb before its shearer is silent, so he did not open his mouth. In his humiliation, he was deprived of justice. Who can speak of his descendants? For his life was taken from the earth." I'm not even going to talk about the intriguing but problematic idea that what Philip makes of this text would have ended Christendom right here if he was taking the text literally. Who can speak of his descendants, because he's been removed from the earth? It's like Jesus got crucified, end of story. Anyway, it's not the way it goes. The eunuch asked Philip, "Tell me, please, who is the prophet talking about, himself or someone else?" Then Philip began with that very passage of Scripture and told him the good news about Jesus. As they traveled along the road, they came to some water, and the eunuch said, "Look, here is water. What can stand in the way of my being baptized?" You're all recognizing representative language here, right? You know, anyway, it's important. "And he gave orders to stop the chariot. Then both Philip and the eunuch went down into the water, and Philip baptized him. When they came up out of the water, the Spirit of the Lord suddenly took Philip away, and the eunuch did not see him again, but went on his way rejoicing. Philip, however, appeared at Azotus and traveled about, preaching the gospel in all the towns until he reached Caesarea." So among other things, the text validates this unto the ends of the earth, and it names a bunch of places, including, and it ends at Caesarea. So from the perspective of the proponents of the spread of this religion, this is a text that validates that mission. It says it actually got there. So let's just jump right into a different set of questions, because I think this is all going on in here as well. And the question I want to jump right into is, who are the spiritual explorers in this story? Because that's this community, right? So what's this story got to say to this community? Well, let's use a different metaphor. Let's ask a question. Who are the people that are having an experience in this story of, in Nouwen's words, leaving the old country and going to the new country? Well, the obvious answer is the Ethiopian, right? He's obviously the one that doesn't fit in. We're going to come back to that in a moment. But first of all, what about the hero of the story? What about Philip? It's super easy, at least for me, to forget when we read stories like this that pretty much all the main characters in them have jumped ship from the prevailing religious systems that surrounded them. If you're reading about the history of Christianity in Christendom's sacred text, in the New Testament, pretty much every one of the heroes in that story is someone that has left the prevailing religious system. It's easy to forget that because the book, among other things, is defending the beginnings of Christendom as a prevailing system. We're reading it from the vantage point of a couple thousand years of history of that religion in the world, over which time it has become an enormously well-established and powerful entity. But these stories are not from that context. These are written about a religion that doesn't really exist yet. It's just starting to emerge as a religion. So that's a super important thing to remember. And this is complicated in the case of Philip because the rabbi whose teachings, the people who are launching Christianity, the rabbi whose teachings they're trying to follow is, as any rabbi would be, a Jew. But he's a Jew that sort of reigned on the Jewish religious leaders' parade. Right? And it's not that Jesus, as a character, as we find Jesus represented in the stories, it's not that Jesus wasn't respectful of their religious context generally. He was. He got invited to speak at conferences, you know, like he got to come and talk at synagogue regularly, at least early on. But then when people started to really parse his ideas and realize that what he was saying was that the old system was broken because it was based on some ideas about God and about scorekeeping and about religious hierarchy that needed to be left behind, the speaking circuit didn't just dry up. It got nasty and it revealed itself as something more like a religious industrial complex that was in no mood to be challenged. Game changed. So the people that are following Jesus, if they're Jewish, are explorers that have already stepped out of the main religious current. They couldn't follow Jesus and stay in it. The case to this day when it comes to Christianity and Judaism. Philip, however, is a Greek name, not a Hebrew name. And it's not unlikely that Acts was written by Luke, who is also generally thought to be a Greek convert to the way of Jesus. And if that's the case, then what Philip has stepped away from is Greek spirituality, which had a host of gods, and he has stepped into the Jesus story, which is built on the Hebrew conception of the divine, which is that God is one. And the Hebrew conception of the divine was built on the Egyptian conception of the divine. So either way, the hero of the story is a spiritual explorer. Either way, Philip is somebody who, in order to pursue what might be the meaning of the teachings of this Jewish rabbi, Jesus, has had to step away from the prevailing religious system, from the story that they grew up with, from the narrative that grounded them, from the old country into new country. So despite the fact that in the context of this story, Philip sounds like the guy with the only legitimate answers to spiritual questions, in the wider context, Philip is an explorer. Philip is a rogue. And so are all the followers of Jesus. Christianity as the religion of empire, the right answer, that doesn't happen for several hundred years. That doesn't happen until Constantine makes it happen. So these early stories in Acts, that's not their context. Which brings us to the Ethiopian, who I will continue to refer to as the text refers to them. He is not from the country or culture of the storyteller. He's not from any of the religions in this story. He's not Jewish, he's not Greek, he's not Christian. And to really put things into overdrive, he's not from the same race as the other characters. And on top of that, he's, well, if he lived in the 21st century West, his preferred pronouns might not be he and him. He's gender nonconforming in an unambiguous way. He is so much outside the prevailing grid that although the story says that he's just been to Jerusalem to worship, what we know about Jewish temple worship means that if he went to worship in Jerusalem, which would mean he went to the Temple Mount, he could get in the very first door, but that's as far as he could get. He had to stay in the outer courtyard. Why? He's not Jewish. He's not Hebrew. Never mind adhering to the religion. He's not of that people group. He's not from that tribe. And he's neither a man nor a woman. He doesn't fit the story of God and humanity the way that religion told it. You want an outsider. This person is an outsider. You want an explorer. This person is an explorer. The Hebrews had a lovely kind of term, at least I find it lovely at a distance, for people who didn't fit the grid, but there was some sense of resonance spiritually with them, and they called them God-fearers. That's who got to be in that outer courtyard. So they had some kind of an idea space for people that were intrigued by the divine, but who didn't fit their religious grid. The Ethiopian is soundly in that space. And although the story makes it sound like he kind of has this come home to Jesus moment in the story, by the end of the tale, what he's really done is just add another layer to his spiritual exploration. Because geographically speaking, as we have the story, he's still on his way home to Ethiopia. He's on his way to a different set of prevailing norms. He doesn't become a Christian in this story in any of the ways that most of us would conceive of what it means to become a Christian. There's no way that could be what this story is about, because most of the ways we think about what it means to be a Christian don't exist yet when this story was told. So, Philip the Evangelist, when you use a phrase like that in the 21st century Christian church, especially around evangelicals, for whom evangelism is like a big deal, means something almost totally different than what's going on in this story. And when Philip explains what Isaiah is talking about is the story of Jesus, when we hear that story told from the pulpits in North America, usually it's from the vantage point of, and here's what we've made of that. Of course it is. This is where we live. But that's not what Philip's doing at all. Everybody in this whole story in the book of Acts is trying to figure out what this means. Everybody in this whole story is trying to figure out what to make of whatever they encountered when they encountered Jesus the rabbi. Paul, for example, who could arguably be understood to be the founder of Christianity rather than Jesus, it's the writings of Paul that give us almost entirely the shape of what we call Christendom, rather than the stories of Jesus. Paul, at the point in this story, happens historically, if we take the record as we have it. Paul, at this point in the story, is still Saul. He's still running around killing the people who are calling themselves Christians when Philip does this. So, to me, it's utterly untenable to believe that what happens between Philip and the Ethiopian in the chariot is the Ethiopian becomes a Christian in any way that I would understand that. What I hear and see in the story is that what the Ethiopian does is they add another entire layer to their spiritual exploration. They add another story to the stories they already have. And it's a profound experience for the Ethiopian, there's no question. They actually engage, they actually receive one of the symbols that is unique to Christendom later on, baptism. But that's already sort of bubbling up in this new movement because John did this with Jesus, right? But it's a long, long time before the thing that we think of as baptism. It's a long, long time before that set of ideas that this story is recorded and told. But the Ethiopian knows that this is not a symbol from their culture. This is a different symbol. This is a different ritual. And when they encounter this new set of spiritual ideas, they're like, what ritual goes with this? What's the pivotal ritual? Well, at this point, it's baptism. I want to experience that. I don't want to insult anyone by being too... I don't want to be simplistic. This is not that moment. This is not that group of people. So forgive me if this feels that way. But sometimes we miss because maybe we just don't take the time to engage our imaginations this way, but we miss the obvious parallels, right? Philip. When Philip takes the Ethiopian down to the water to be baptized, he's essentially doing the same thing that his community does when it gives this a place on the table with this and this and that and that. Does this make sense? Another layer to the exploration. Another encounter with something that feels like, that's new to me. That's not where I'm from. But it's about what I'm about. It's about why I went to Jerusalem going, what's going on here? It's about why I would put up with being in the outer courtyard of an established religion and call that experience worship, even though there's no way I could ever get to the inside because I'm the wrong color, I'm from the wrong country, and I'm not gendered the way this story says everybody is gendered. Right? You know, I find it intriguing that tradition credits the Ethiopian eunuch with bringing Christianity to Ethiopia. And Christianity is very old in Ethiopia, almost as old there as anywhere else on the planet as far as we can discern. So there's something kind of lovely about that connection. But just for a moment, if the Ethiopian eunuch is the person that takes Christianity to Ethiopia, what do you think they arrived with when they got home? What did they bring? They didn't bring anything like what we imagine when we imagine Christianity today. Because it didn't exist. So whatever the Ethiopian eunuch carried back to the court, whatever happened to the Ethiopian spirituality in that moment of exploration and transformation and conversion, it wasn't that they became anything like what you and I imagine when we imagine a Christian. It's impossible. Because there wasn't anything like that to become. The frame wasn't there. That's fascinating to me. Because among other things, it tells me that, let me just see if I can sum this up. If you feel like your spiritual journey has you stepping away from the story that you grew up with, including some versions of the Jesus story, then part of my hope is that an exploration like this has made it clear that you not only have company in the here and now, but you have company in the there and then. You have the company of everyone that has ever looked at the religious system they grew up in and had that feeling that this is a country I need to leave, and that is both frightening and exhilarating. You have the company of the earliest followers of Jesus, including that band of rebels that turned the teaching of Jesus into a religion, making it up as they went along, like we encounter in a story like this. You have the company of a non-gender conforming racial minority, powerful in their own context, but a profound outsider in the one where they encountered a spiritual next in some mysterious way. You have the company of this weirdly hopeful story and a host of others like it. And of course, you have the company of this community of explorers. And so even if Henri Nouwen is on track when he writes that the only way to go down a new road is naked and vulnerable, if you don't remember anything else from this particular part of our gathering together this morning, I hope you remember that you don't have to go alone. Peace.